Thanks for the introduction. And it's a great pleasure for me to visit PI. And I'd like to thank Roger, Sunsik, and Guffrey for inviting me here. Yeah. So my talk is about a theoretical study of how quenched disorder affects different types of electronic orders in high-TC superconductor. Yeah. So before I start, let me just say a few words about the motivation. Why are we still interested in high-TC superconductors, despite the fact that it has already been studied for more than 30 years? So it seems an old topic. So what are the new things? Well, high-TC is interesting, not just because the TC is high, but also because there are so many closely competing phases in this phase diagram with similar energies. So this, first of all, stimulates the developments in experimental techniques. And people have developed all sorts of new generation experimental techniques to characterize and study those phases. In fact, we will have a glimpse of those experiments later in the talk. Secondly, from a theoretical and numerical perspectives, high-TC is a test ground, or say, a laboratory for theorists to generate new ideas. Those ideas are motivated by experiments, but in the end, maybe they're not able to explain all the experiments in high-TC because there are so much data there. But those theorists themselves are innovative and mathematically beautiful. So that's the two or three motivations for studying high-TC. From my personal perspective. Yeah. So feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions or confusion about the terminologies. Okay. So let me first thank my collaborators, especially Roger and Lauren, who are in the audience, who did a very beautiful Monte Carlo simulation, which I will mention later in the talk. Okay. So let's go back to the phase diagram. This is the temperature versus doping cuprate or copper-based high-TC superconductor phase diagram. This is the antiferromagnetic phase, and this is superconductivity phase. And there is a strong fluctuating regime of charge density wave and spin density wave, and also a nematic phase here. So in this talk, we're going to focus on this right-hand side of the phase diagram for the large doping regime. So we're not going to focus on the antiferromagnetic regime. So first of all, let me quickly introduce what are those phases. So first, CDW, charge density wave. It's a modulation of charge density. So suppose we start from a square lattice. And on top of that, we have a stripy or unidirectional charge modulation. So compared to the square lattice, what symmetries does the CDW break? It breaks both the C4 rotational symmetry, which is the 90 degree rotation symmetry of the square lattice, and also the translational symmetry of the square lattice. Suppose the wave vector or wavelength of this charge modulation is 3 times my lattice constant, then the translational symmetry is broken it's a discrete symmetry, translational symmetry breaking. Because the charge density wave selects one state out of the 3 possible states. Okay? And suppose, on the other hand, if the wavelength of this charge modulation is square root of two times the lattice constant, then this charge density wave breaks a continuous symmetry of the square lattice. So square of 2 or other incommensurate or irrational number of wavelength is called incommensurate density wave. So this is seen in experiments. So in our study, we only consider incommensurate charge density wave, which breaks continuous translational symmetry. Okay, so that's the symmetry perspectives of charge density wave.
In the beginning, translation symmetry is discrete.
Yes.
When you say continuous.
Yeah. So
all the translation.
So the square lattice does it is okay. If the wavelength of the charge density wave is an irrational number of the lattice constant, then it doesn't care the lattice at all.
There's no residual.
It doesn't matter where the charge density wave starts. So for example, for a commensurate charge density wave, the charge density wave would like to have a lock-in with the lattice to minimize the Coulomb energy. But for an incommensurate charge density wave, the lattice seems to be non-existing from the perspective of the charge density wave, because they are not locking, their wave vector or wavelength do not match at all. So
in that sense, it's a restore of the continuum.
Yes. In that sense, it's the lattice doesn't exist. So it's breaking a continuous symmetry.
It's restored it and then it's broken it a different way.
Sorry?
Yeah. So it's restored it and then it's broken it a different way.
Simultaneously, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but it's still the incommensurate charge density wave is once it forms, it's choosing a specific state out of a continuous manifold. So it's a continuous symmetry breaking.
Confusing, maybe it's maybe terminology, but
mm-hmm.
before charge density wave, you have discrete translational symmetry.
Yes.
After charge density wave, there's no translation symmetry at all.
There's still translational symmetry because you form a charge density wave, but that's a okay. Let's see. As John said, you restore and break the continuous symmetry at once. When you
restore, you have legs, underlying legs.
I see. Okay.
Just basically means that if you look at the lattice, there is just one kind of translation symmetry, so it's that one vector.
Yes.
If you look at the other parameters, then there is another kind of translation symmetry with different, say, vector magnitude.
So you have a lattice, and on top of that, you have an incommensurate charge density wave. Those together restore the continuous symmetry. Yeah. We can talk about that offline.
Matter of terminology,
yeah.
As you say.
Yeah. So when there is only lattice, it does break the. It is a discrete symmetry. The translational symmetry is reduced to discrete symmetry, but now on top of that, you have incommensurate charge density wave, and then the two together restore the continuous symmetry.
Maybe physical question: is there a conserved momentum? When you say restore, it sounds like you have some emergent conserved charge, but there's no conserved.
I think you still have momentum. There is no disorder. So for a clean system.
Of course, in Nikola, there's no. Yeah. Momentum is conserved only up to a lattice moment.
Mm-hmm. So when you say Wukulam, you mean we're not talking about
so there's
scattering.
No, there's no nodal charge. There's no continuous translation. So there's no conserved moment with lattice.
With respect to the lattice, that's true. But you still have a momentum because you have continuous symmetry. Like, once you have the incommensurate charge density wave, you first restore.
They are conserved only up to reciprocal legs.
Yes. So, okay. I'm still don't quite understand what your confusion is, but maybe we can go on and you talk offline. Yeah. So, right. As I said, we're only considering incommensurate charge density wave, which means it breaks. Once it forms an incommensurate charge density wave states, it breaks continuous symmetry. And similarly, for spin density wave, experimentally, we've also seen this stripy structure for the spin density wave. So it means breaks both C4 rotational and translational symmetry. On the other hand, there is a pneumatic phase here at higher temperature, which breaks only the 90-degree rotation symmetry. So in our theory, well, there can be many different origins or explanations for why this pneumatic phase happens. But in our theory, we view this pneumatic phase as a partially melted density weight. So pictorially, it looks like this. The translational symmetry is restored here, but the rotational symmetry is still broken. As you can see, the x and y directions are still inequivalent. So that's how we view the pneumatic phase. And the orders we're going to study here are charge density wave, spin density wave, superconductivity, as well as an associated pneumatic order coming from the density waves. So this is the outline of my talk. We're first starting from a simplest case where we have only charge density waves coupling to a quenched random field disorder. Specifically, we're going to talk about how continuous symmetry breaking phase and Ising symmetry breaking phase behave or are affected under the influence of disorder. The second part of my talk is adding some variation, which is the superconductivity. Here we're focusing on a physical quantity, which is the CDW structure factor, which can be measured by X-ray experiment. And finally, we're going to talk about two density waves plus disorder, specifically whether there can be two types of pneumatic phase driven by different density waves. So that's a question mark. So for those of you who are interested in the details, those are the references. Okay, so let's start from the simplest case. Before we dive into the theory, let me show you quickly some experiments. There have been a lot of X-ray scattering experiments showing that there's a short-range charge density wave regime. By saying short-range, I mean the fluctuation is observable, it's relatively strong, but it's not a truly long-ranged phase. It's not a phase, it's only a fluctuating regime. So this is X-ray experiments in YBCO. This is intensity versus momentum. Because charge density wave is a modulation, so the intensity should peak at the corresponding wave vector. If it's a perfect charge density wave, if it's a phase, then the peak should be a delta function with zero width. But now, as you can see, if you look at this gray bump, there is a not well-defined peak, but there is something compared to the background. So, and from the width of this peak, we can determine the correlation length of this charge modulation. And it's about 20 lattice constant, which is 4 or 5 times the wavelength of the charge density wave. So it's not long-range correlated. It's a fluctuation, strong fluctuation of charge density wave. On the other hand, oh, by the way, so I would like to point out, yes, so in this phase diagram, this blue line is not a phase transition. It's a crossover from weak fluctuating as CDW to strong fluctuation CDW. So this peak corresponds to here. We can see something in the X-ray, but not truly long range. On the other hand, there's evidence for a long-ranged pneumaticity in experiments. So here I'm showing you STM data on another type of cuprates, BISCO 2212. If you look at the inset, so the inset is plotting the intensity of the Bragg, basically the intensity of the Bragg peaks along X and Y directions. If the system is a C4 symmetric, meaning that if the X and Y directions are equivalent, then the black and white XY direction Bragg peaks should have the same intensity. But now they're different, indicating that there is a pneumatic phase there. And this difference between XY directions persists to very large distance, about 90 lattice constant. So this is the evidence for a relatively long-range nematicity. Okay, so yeah, before I introduce you our model, let me just briefly mention there's a general argument which can be applied to the case of cuprates, which can explain why they are long-range nematicity and short-range charge density wave. So this argument was proposed first by Emery and Ma. It says that there is no continuous symmetry breaking phase in 3D. So we're considering classical system here. So it's 3+0D. There's no continuous symmetry breaking phase in 3D if there is quenched random field. And in the context of cuprates, it means that the incommensurate charge density wave order, which breaks continuous symmetry, will be killed in real materials where disorder is inevitable. On the other hand, the argument also says for discrete symmetry breaking, if the disorder is weak enough, the discrete symmetry breaking phase can survive in 3D. So that means the nematic order, which is an Ising type of order, is long range. The reason is the Ising type of order is because you can have x plus or minus 1, x larger than y or y larger than x. So that's a discrete symmetry breaking. Yeah. So this Imurima argument is like a disorder version of the Mermin-Wagner.
You really haven't told us what the disorder is and why it couples to the order parameter.
Right, I will tell you in the next slide. So we would like to just do an explicit calculation, which is a manifestation of the argument I just told you. So we wrote down a Ginzburg-Landau theory consisting of charge density wave order parameters and disorder. So this is charge density at position r, which can be decomposed into a background uniform charge and a spatially varying fluctuating part, which can be further decomposed into a slow varying phi x, phi y, and a fast oscillating part with wave vectors qx and qy. Qs, qy are the charge density wave order parameters. So we have two charge density waves. Q and QY are the charge density wave vectors. And phi X and phi Y are the charge density wave order parameters. So we write down a theory consisting of phi X and phi Y. Okay, the theory should respect this symmetry. So the SO2s come from the fact that phi X and phi Y are complex fields. So phi X is complex, phi Y is also complex. And Z2 comes from the fact that interchanging X and Y or rotating by 90 degrees should not change the theory, should not change our Hamiltonian. So based on this principle, we write down the following Hamiltonian. So this is a classical field theory. So the first two terms are mass term and gradient terms. Okay, and then U and delta are quartic terms. So U must be larger than zero to make sure the theory, the energy, free energy is bounded. And in our calculation, we take U to be positive infinite so that this total magnitude is fixed to be one. So it becomes a nonlinear sigma model. For delta, the sign of delta determines whether the system likes to be stripe or checkerboard. So stripe means the two CWs, only one of the two CWs orders. Checkerboard means they both orders. So for delta larger than zero, you can see that phi x does not want to be equal to phi y to minimize the energy, right? So if delta is smaller than zero, then phi x wants to be equal to phi y. And in our calculation, we take delta to be positive. Yeah. So this final term is a linear coupling between a random field H and my order parameters phi x, phi y. So we assume that h on different sites are uncorrelated. And on each site, h obey Gaussian distribution. So the mean is zero and the variance is sigma square. So the sigma square here characterizes the strength of the disorder. So this type of linear coupling is called random field disorder. If I have h times phi x squared, that's called random mass. And that's less detrimental compared to random field.
So why does it couple only to phi x plus phi 1?
Phi x, oh, you mean there should be a phi x minus phi y?
Well, why don't you have, I mean, you have this symmetry, this SO2,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So it's not really a random field acting in that whole manifold, right?
That's right.
So it's pointing in a particular direction somehow in that space. And how it's random, I mean, it has a random phase, but that's all, right?
So are you saying that I should have hx and hy?
Well, I don't know. You seem to have chosen a particular linear combination of phi x and phi y, and I don't understand why.
So I have to preserve the symmetry of Z2.
That's the Z2 symmetry.
Right. So if I interchange x and y, this term should remain the same. So that's why it's a shorthand notation for I should have hx and hy.
Okay.
And hx and xy obey the same Gaussian distribution to make sure that interchanging x and y does not change the theory.
But they're independent.
Yes.
So there's an hx and an xy
yes.
which have the same distribution.
Yes. Yeah. More rigorously, it should be like that.
At each site, you're locally breaking the Z2 symmetry. Or not?
At each site,
so
at four.
Locally breaking the Z2 symmetry?
Yes. So for one disorder configuration, one specific disorder configuration, it does break the Z2 symmetry.
Yeah.
But disorder averagely,
yeah,
no.
Right.
It doesn't break
right.
the Z2 symmetry.
It's really HX and HY.
Yes. That's right. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, thanks for pointing this out. Yeah. Okay. So to deal with disorder, we first do replica trick, which is a standard technique in disorder system. And then we decouple those two quartic terms using Haber-Stratonovich transformation. And we do large N and find the saddle point solution. So N here is the number of components for each order parameter. So physical case is N equals to 2, but we push N to be infinity to make our calculation easier. Okay, so let me show you the result. This is the phase diagram as a function of temperature and disorder strength. So let's first look at this line when disorder is zero. There are three phases. A striped phase, which means a unidirectional charge density wave, and a pneumatic phase, and an isotropic phase. So to characterize those phases, we use those three order parameters. Overline here means disorder configuration average. And this left-right angle means thermal average. So phi x and phi y characterize whether CDW is ordered or not. And this n, which is the difference between phi x and phi y, characterize the pneumatic phase. So for striped phase, for example, it's when phi x orders, phi y does not order. And of course, I have an inequivalency between x and y direction. For the pneumatic phase, is phi x, phi y both do not order, but I can have a non-zero n. And you may ask, how can this happen? When phi x and phi y both are zero, how can I have a non-zero pneumaticity? Well, it can happen just as shown in the two plots. So remember that this N, this pneumatic order parameter, filters out the phase information of the charge density wave. So there is absolute value here. So the pneumatic order parameter does not care about the phase of the charge density wave. So it's the following scenario happens. So when we increase temperature or increase disorder, the phase fluctuation heals the charge density wave, making those two things to be equal to zero. But the orientation information is still there. So the pneumaticity is non-zero. That's the physical picture. And this homogeneous isotropic phase is when everything, every order dies. Okay. As we increase disorder, the stripe unidirectional charge density wave phase is immediately killed, leaving behind a pneumatic phase. And this pneumatic phase survives up to a critical disorder strength, which is about 2.35 times the J. J is the coefficient of the gradient terms. So it's the pneumatic phase is pretty robust. This is not a small number. Okay. And if we compare those two phase diagrams, this is just very rough comparison. There's no fitting of experimental data here. So this is a temperature versus doping. And there's a pneumatic line here, just like the pneumatic transition here. So we can have some wild imagination that there might be a pneumatic quantum critical point here under the superconducting dome. You might say that, well, your model is a classical model. So that's why I'm saying this is an imagination or just a rough generalization. So we are guessing that maybe if there is a quantum critical point here, it might have the nature of a pneumatic phase transition. Yes. So one experiment is the BISCO STM I just showed you. So the inequivalency of the rack peaks intensity along x and y directions. And the other is.
So Seamus didn't do that as a function of temperature.
No. So they only have one like data point or.
Right.
And there is another experiment on EU doped L at CO. Yeah. And also experiments on YBCO, but YBCO is controversial because it's already orthorhombic. But so the reason I said there is a quantum critical point here is that there are other experiments all lying along this line, the pseudo gap line, that pointing towards some sort of critical point. But we don't know what that critical point is. So we're just conjecturing that that critical point, one aspect of that critical point is a pneumatic phase transition. So yeah, there might be some other things happening across this line. So okay, so this problem of pneumatic fluctuation coupling to a gapless fermion, just as we saw here, we have a fermion forming superconductivity and a pneumatic quantum critical point. So this problem recently has been studied by quantum Monte Carlo, by those groups. And they indeed see that the pneumatic critical bosons will enhance the fermionic superconductivity pairing. I'm not involved in this work, but this is a growing and very interesting direction. Okay. So a quick summary of the first part. We study the explicit model of the and manifesting Emery mass argument and showed that when there's quench random field, the CW cannot be long ranged, but the pneumaticity can survive to up to a critical disorder strength.
Does this argument
apply to randomness? No. Random mass does not couple to the phase fluctuation of the order parameter. So random mass looks like H pi square. So this, it can, yeah. So this is less detrimental than random field. Yeah. But random mass also alters the critical dimensions, I think, but not as strongly as random field does. Yeah. Okay. So the second part of my talk is a similar model with charge density wave and also superconductivity. So now we have three SO2 order parameters. This is the symmetry our Hamiltonian should obey. A Z2 still comes from the XY 90 degree rotation. Okay, so let me show you the Hamiltonian. It looks long, but it's very similar to the previous Hamiltonian. First, we have a mass term of the three order parameters and the gradient terms. And right now, I'm explicitly writing down the gradient terms along z direction, because later we will study also the effect of Jz. Yeah. And then the u term, which is constraining the total magnitude of the three order parameters, and also delta term. And this g term is there, g prime term. I don't know why I call it G prime, but this term is there because we have additional order parameter, so there should be additional quartic term.
Why is the U term involving both the charge density wave and the
superconductivity? That's a good question. That's motivated by the fact that superconductivity and charge density waves are competing with each other in cuprates. I will show you, you can see that from the data. So once those guys order, superconductivity does not want to order. The total magnitude.
So
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so that almost looks like it has some higher symmetry. But if you turned off the other terms, this would have an even higher symmetry.
Yeah. So in our calculation, actually, we have a different coefficient here.
Okay.
So I'm just writing down the simplified model.
Right.
So, and also this delta term also breaks that SO6 symmetry. Yeah. Okay, and okay, so this last term is a random field coupling between CDW and this order. So again, we take U to be positive infinite and delta larger than zero, so it favors stripe charge density wave. So I'd like to say something about this term. So you might ask, why cannot we have a term like this? So a random field coupled to a superconductivity order parameter. It cannot be there because of gauge invariance. So for superconductivity, the lowest order is like this, H phi norm square. This term is not in our Hamiltonian because this term, which makes superconductivity and charge density wave talk to each other, plus this term together gives an indirect interaction between H and psi. So superconductivity indirectly talk to disorder in this fashion. So we do not explicitly include this term anymore. Okay, so we solve this model by two methods. One is the same as before, replica trick plus saddle point solution. In the large end limit, it's an analytical approach, which includes some approximations. The other is a exact numerical simulation, so performed by Lauren and Roger. There, it's n equals to 2, where n is the number of components for each order parameter. So this is the physical case. This is the approximated case. And we will see their comparison.
General n, do you enlarge z2 into zn, or how do you?
Oh, for general n, it's still z2. It's still this.
Phi x and phi y individually come with n components.
Yes, phi x comes with n components, and phi y comes with n components. Yeah. Okay. So, right now I'm going to show you the results. So here, we are not computing the phase diagram. Instead, we're looking for just focusing on a specific quantity, which is the CDW structure factor. It's basically the correlation function of my CDW order parameter. Okay. The reason we're focusing on this is because it has been measured by X-ray experiments. So this is the data from Dave's group. This is the CDW correlation. This is temperature. As you cool down the system, the CDW wants to order. The correlation wants to diverge. But then it drops. When it drops, TC superconductivity kicks in. So from this, we know that experimentally, CDW and superconductivity are competing with each other. Okay, so that's just experimental phenomena. So here I'm showing you those colorful lines are Monte Carlo results on another model. It's very similar to the model I just showed you, but with no disorder and in the purely 2D limit, meaning that the JZ term I mentioned is zero. So this model gives us a very good fit in this intermediate temperature regime. But at low temperature, their CDW correlation goes to zero. So that's one discrepancy, the structure factor, zero temperature behavior of the structure factor. Another discrepancy is the following. So I have TC here, and also I have a peak temperature, which I call Tmax, which is the peak, the location of the peak of the CDW structure factor. So this Tmax and TC are very close to each other from experiments, indicating the competition. But in the Monte Carlo simulation of the clean 2D model, the TC is here. So they're able to fix the match the Tmax, but not the TC. So Tmax and TC are not very close in the 2D clean model. Okay, now we are going to turn on disorder and interlayer coupling JZ to see how those discrepancies can be fixed. First, let's turn on disorder. So this is done for a fixed finite JZ. So it's a quasi 2D, or you can think of a 3D system with varying disorder. So again, structure factor, CDW correlation versus temperature. So there are many lines here. Let me walk you through each line. The smooth curves, 1, 2, 3, 4, those are results from the analytical solution. And the curves with dots are results from Monte Carlo simulation. Okay. There are several pieces of information we can extract from this plot. So first of all, let's look at the smooth curve, which is the analytical result. As we increase disorder from 0 to 1.3, at zero temperature, we see a finite value of the charge density wave correlation. So increasing disorder can help us fix the low temperature discrepancy. A second piece of information is that the vertical bars, which are a little bit short, small here, they are the TC, the superconductivity transition temperature in our calculation. And if you look carefully enough, as you increase disorder from here to here, the Tmax, where the peak locates, and TC, which is the short vertical bar, become closer to each other. So increasing disorder alone can fix those two discrepancies together. And we don't have and also the third piece of information is the Monte Carlo results, which are the dots, and the analytical results agree very well, except near the intermediate temperature where there is a superconductivity transition. So when there is a transition, the large N doesn't work that well. But at high and low temperature, they agree pretty well. We don't have a data, Monte Carlo data for the largest disorder because generally it's very hard to perform Monte Carlo for large disorder. For this intermediate disorder, you can already see that there's some wiggle in the data. Okay, the next thing we're doing here is fix disorder strength and vary the interlayer coupling. It's tuning the dimensionality of the system. So from Jz equals to zero, purely 2D, to Jz equals to 0.1, a quasi-2D. Okay, so again, the smooth curves are analytical results, and the points here are Monte Carlo results. By the way, the line across the points are just connecting those points. It's not fitting or whatever. Yeah. So the information from this plot is that increasing Jz, again, can make the two temperatures becoming closer to each other. For example, this vertical bar here and the T max, the peak, are far away. But if we increase disorder for this green curve, they're very close. They become very close to each other. So we've shown here that increasing disorder and increasing interlayer coupling can help us fix the discrepancies. And I would like to just mention or address again that the agreement between our large analytical calculation and the Monte Carlo results is in some sense surprising and astonishing. Because in this analytical calculation, we took n to be infinity, whereas in Monte Carlo, n is 2. And also in the analytical calculation, we used replica trick, which is not guaranteed to work. Sometimes it fails. But here, it seems to work well. So this gives us confidence in applying replica trick and large N method in effective field theory models. Okay, so a quick summary of the second part. We study Landau-Ginzburg theory consisting of three order parameters, two CWs and one superconductivity. And we showed that disorder and dimensionality of the system are important if we want a good agreement between theory and experiments. Okay, so the last part is right. Now we have two types of density waves and a disorder. Again, two CDWs and two SDWs. So those CDWs are perpendicular to each other, SDWs are perpendicular to each other. And the Hamiltonian of the system consists of three terms, SDW part, spin, CDW part, and their interactions. So the CDW part looks just like before. We have mass term, gradient term, and a U term. This is another, this U and gamma together, if you reshuffle them, you get the U and delta before. Okay, and a random field coupling between CW and disorder. The spin density wave part is also similar. You might ask, can I have this type of coupling between a random field and the spin density wave vector? The answer is no, because it breaks time reversal symmetry. So the lowest order allowed is random mass coupling for the spin density wave. But again, we're not considering this term because the spin density wave is indirectly talking to the disorder in this fashion through interaction. Okay, and right, so those two mass terms, previously, in our previous two models, we took them to be constant, but here, we're imposing a temperature dependency of those two terms. They look like this. So for the charge density wave, this is temperature, this is x, some tuning parameter, which we assume it's a doping. So we put in doping by hand in our model. It's a phenomenological model. So this alpha phi depends on doping in a trivial way, which is constant. So it's the usual form we see, like alpha 0 times t minus t2, where t2 is the bare transition or mean field transition of the charge density wave. And for this SDW, we assume it takes this form. So t1 times 1 minus x. T1 is this temperature. And T1 times 1 minus x is just a way we impose the doping in our theory. And the reason we take those two mean field or bare transition temperature to be this shape is because we want to just roughly mimic the cuprate phase diagram. So I have a CDW and SDW. So you might ask, this SDW transition temperature is so low. That's true, but there is a strong SDW fluctuation at finite frequency at higher temperature. So this is static, this is finite frequency. So roughly, this looks like this. It's just a choice of modeling. Okay, so that's this two Hamiltonian. And finally, we have interaction between the SDW and CDW. It looks like this. So I have phi x sx, phi y sy, and phi x sy, phi y sx. So those two terms, if v is larger than w, it will favor a mutually perpendicular charge density wave and spin density wave. If it's v smaller than w, then they prefer to be parallel. So it's just a choice of parameters.
Is there any relation between u, x, y, and like kx and ky?
Oh, that's a very good question. So in our theory, in this model, they are not related at all. But that's the case in YBCO. But in lanthanum-based copper oxide, they differ by a factor of 2. So they are locked in. And if they're locked in, if we want to capture the lock-in effect in our theory, we need some other terms, which we don't have right now. So you can view this theory as a theory for YBCO. Yeah. Okay, so let me show you the results. This is a phase, this is just the two lines I just showed you. It's a mean field or bare transition for SCW and CDW when there is no interaction or no spatial fluctuation. And now I know disorder. Now I turn on, I keep disorder to be zero, but I turn on spatial fluctuation, which is the gradient term, and also the interaction between the two density waves. And you can see that the transition temperatures are suppressed a lot. And at low temperature, there's a coexisting phase. So the SDW line is bended as well as the CDW line. And this small region is where they coexist. At intermediate temperature, there is a pneumatic transition. So all the lines here are second orders. And in this sliver of pneumatic phase, this is true all the way in this pneumatic phase. So Sx squared is larger than Sy, and sorry, I should change the notation here. This is phi y larger than phi x. This means, so there's no sign changing. Like this inequality does not change sign across this region. So this is the one pneumatic phase, despite the fact that it is driven by different density waves. So if you look at here, the SDW fluctuation along y direction, along x direction will be stronger along than y direction. And if you look at here, the CW fluctuation along y direction will be stronger than x direction. And they are driving the pneumatic phase respectively in this region and in this region. But overall, it's one pneumatic phase. So that's the take-home message of this model. Although you have two origins of pneumaticity, there's no transition here inside the pneumatic phase. And if the V and W term, which is the mutual interaction between CW and SCW, are very large, then the coexisting phase is gone. It's replaced by a first order transition. But the pneumatic phase is still there. Okay, now let's see the result for finite disorder. So this is zero disorder. Finite disorder is like this. So the CDW is completely gone because the disorder is a random field for charge-density wave, as we have mentioned that it will be completely killed by the random field disorder. And SCW penetrates into larger doping regime. And the pneumatic phase survives. And this region has a strong CDW fluctuation, although it doesn't have any CDW phase anymore. So this is a reminiscence of this phase diagram. So I have SCW, CDW, and a one universal pneumatic phase.
In your calculation, you know how the CDW correlation lines depends on disorder stress?
CDW correlation lines depends on
disorder stress in that chain.
So we didn't do that calculation in this model, but we did do that calculation in the very first model, which is only CDW plus disorder.
I don't mean experiments.
Oh, experiments.
Both experiments are theory, but in experiments, it seems to be quite insensitive to disorder. I don't know.
You mean, so CW correlation length is insensitive to doping in experiments?
Disorder. So on YBCO, the dominant source of disorder is oxygen defects.
Mm-hmm.
And on dairy, oxygen defect correlation length is seen.
I see. So the way you vary oxygen defect is by annealing differently?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anneal the sample.
I see.
That same oxygen contact is just a different order of the oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And why do you see what's known to oxygen primary defect?
Okay. So yeah, we didn't do that calculation, but that's a good point. Maybe we should do the comparison. Yeah.
So I've got a quick question on this slide. So the SCW here, is that a long range order?
Yes, it is a phase.
And the experiments though are short range SCW, right?
It's short range up to high temperature. So a very low temperature, for example, this part, I think it's glassy behavior. Is that right?
Yeah,
I think this is, yeah, this is a
sharp.
Yeah, I would need to double check this. I think this is a this might have some glassy behavior. So yeah, I would need to double check this. So if this is a short range, then okay, our model is not able to capture that short range. But if we can include a very strong disorder to CDW, which means it indirectly talked to SCW also very strongly, then perhaps this phase will be killed, leaving behind only a short range SCW as well. So, okay, so a quick summary. We study this model and we showed that there's a universal pneumatic transition across the entire doping range, although it's driven by different fluctuations, the density wave fluctuations. Okay, so this is a summary of my talk. We studied three cases. Both, all of them are random field disorder coupled to charge density wave. and with some additional order parameters. And in the first case, we showed that there's a short-range CDW and long-range pneumaticity in agreement with experiments. And the second case, we showed that the disorder and dimensionality are important. And thirdly, we showed that there's a one pneumatic phase. So it's giving some hints to the cuprates, but we're not making a strong affirmative claim that in cuprates it is a one pneumatic phase. There may be some other things going on which are not captured by our effective field theory model. Okay, so that's the end of my talk.
Can I ask a question? So you said that if you consider all three different phases, I mean all three components, insertions, intensity phase, and disorder, you get on the pneumatic phase, but you don't get the actual charge intensity wave. So my question, for example, in the experimental phase diagram, okay, is there actual charge intensity wave phase? I mean, from experimental point of view, is there a charge density wave, actual charge density wave in this galactic phase?
So are you asking whether in experiments it's a charge density wave phase? Or
yeah.
It's a low field or zero field, it's a fluctuation regime, it's not a phase.
I mean, on the phase diagram, for example, that you showed,
So you mean in the space diagram?
Yeah, on the top. Yeah.
So you're asking whether this is a phase or not?
Yeah.
It's not a phase in YB field at low field.
It's a short range.
It's a short range order. Okay. A phase means it's a truly long range, infinite correlation length order. But this, from X-ray experiments, we know that the scattering peak in the X-ray spectrum has finite width, it's not a delta function, so it's a short range phase.
And is it the same as your theory predicts in the presence of superconductivity?
Sorry?
Is it the same as your theory predicts?
The same as?
Yeah, as to what your theory predicts. I mean, does your theory also predict that there has to be a short range in the phase?
So let's go back to the second model where we have superconductivity.
Yeah, I think it was the last.
Yeah. So, right, this theory has a relatively complicated phase diagram. We did have the phase diagram in this paper, although in the next slide I was showing you only the structure factor, but we did calculate the phase diagram.
Mm-hmm.
And there are phases of coexisting long-range CDW and superconductivity. And there is also a phase with only superconductivity or only CDW. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're not able to say, well, according to experiments, maybe on the phase diagram, the physical material look just falls into the region on the phase diagram where there is only superconductivity, but no long-range charge density wave.
Mm.
Yeah.
No long-range, but there is short-range.
It's short-range, yeah.
For high TC material.
Mm-hmm.
So you're suggesting that there must be some thermodynamic transition associated with the pneumatic phase transition?
So in our calculation, we view that as a pneumatic phase.
Okay.
So yes.
So but experimentally, no one has seen thermodynamic signature.
Thermodynamic signature, not see, it's not seen in YBCO, but it is seen in lanthanum-based.
So in what experiment?
In specific heat.
Specific heat.
So they see a little signature in the specific heat, but that alone does not tell you it's a pneumatic transition.
It's
right. So on top of that, specific heat experiments, they also measured. It's a group in Croatia, so they also measured the third order conductivity. So, they measure this thing. Now, this is a tensor, so it can give you some symmetry information. And so they derived that thermodynamic phase transition is a nematic transition from this measurement. Yeah. So they first see a thermodynamic transition by specific heat, and then prove that that transition is a nematic by measuring this quantity. Yeah. But that's only lanthanum based.
So in that material, the nematic quantum critical form is supposed to be somewhere near optimal openness.
Let's see. In that material, so yeah, I should be careful that in that material is, I think it's EU doped LSCO. For this material, I'm not quite sure about the experimental evidence of a quantum critical point. A lot of the quantum critical points experiments are done in YBCO. So yeah, it's kind of, we are treating them as a big family, and we're treating different materials as an entire family. So, but I hope there are someone doing thermodynamic experiments on YBCO.
Somehow, the nematic fluctuation is the strongest here. It has the largest tenant scale than any other.
Yes. Right? Yes.
And don't we expect larger thermodynamic signature?
What do you mean by larger thermodynamic?
Oh,
I see. That's a quantitative issue, I think. Yeah. Yeah. But in this experiment, their signature in the specific heat is pretty obvious. It's not like you can see it from the raw data. So, yeah. You don't need any fancy data.
In other materials.
In YBCO, I'm not aware of any thermodynamic measurements of a pneumatic phase.
Or
BSCO. I don't think so. And in YBCO, I should say it's controversial because it's not, the lattice is already orthorhombic. So, yeah.
So when you have a random field that couples to a continuous symmetry, the lower critical dimension is supposed to be 4, I believe.
Yes.
And when it couples to discrete one, it's 2. So
it's 2, yes.
So does that somehow explain the fact that the strike phase gets destroyed immediately because it's a continuous
yes.
one, whilst the dynamic one
is
a discrete?
Discrete,
one.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So
yes.
The replica trick, though, you were worried about the application of this, and I think it's believed that that's okay for the continuous symmetry because it does predict that the upper critical dimension is 4. But if you use a replica trick for a discrete symmetry, it predicts the lower critical dimension is 3,
yes,
and not 2. So I would be worried about using the replica trick for the discrete symmetry in 3 dimensions.
But for the continuous symmetry, if I have random mass,
random mass is okay. But
random mass,
but I'm talking about random field.
Random field with continuous symmetry.
Okay, so
yeah.
So if you assume there's no replica symmetry breaking and everything else, then you get dimensional reduction by 2 as compared with the pure model, right? So that correctly gives you 4 dimensions for a continuous symmetry, incorrectly gives you 3 dimensions for a discrete one. So, but you are using replicas all the time.
For the continuous symmetry. Wow.
And the discrete symmetry also, presumably.
Well, the discrete symmetry autoparameter is constructed based from the continuous symmetry autoparameter.
Yeah.
So I'm not directly using replica trick to the discrete symmetry autoparameter.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe that's all. Yeah.
So I seem to recall a few years ago there was a paper from Una King and her collaborators where they looked at the coupling between semantic phase and the Mattie City
mm-hmm.
in Bismuth's 2212 system,
mm-hmm.
where they did STM.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they also have some interesting theory about the mutual pinning of topological
defects. Yeah.
So I was wondering whether here, I mean, I understand that it's almost, it's very hard to do STM or do things on YBCO or LSCO, but I was wondering whether from purely theoretical perspective, whether you can make similar statements about these interactions between topological defects from the charge density wave and topological defects from the pneumatic order.
I see.
May I ask you a question? What does topological defects for the charge density waves and pneumatic orders look like? I have a question for you. What does the topological defects for charge density waves and pneumatic orders?
That would be a dislocation.
Hmm?
That would be dislocation.
So, yeah, it would be like... like, this would be a defect for the density wave. This one.
Why is it topological?
Why is it topological? I would call it defects. I don't know why Una.
Well, if you
call
the only parameter of charging the wave is a complex field. So if you look at the phase around that defect,
yeah.
It winds by 2 pi.
Hmm.
So it's essentially the same as a phase of ordinance.
Yeah, so think about, okay, now it's think about XY model, where you have a complex, you have a like angle, which is like the face of this complex outer parameter. And there you can have vertices, which is topological defects. So that's why this is also topological defects. That's why they call them topological, I guess. Yeah. But regarding to your question, I haven't thought about that. I'm not sure, so
okay.
I need to think about that.
Any further questions? Okay, let's thank you. Let me again.